The story of Two Pistol Pete is a total work of fiction. Some of the characters in the book were based on real people and real jobs that they had in and around Bally's Mines, Missouri. None of the real names were used, and any similarities between the real residents and the fictitious characters are purely coincidental. The old mining town of Bally's Mines is a very real place. Visit us here at our museum, and you can see some of the old buildings and historic sites in which the book is based upon. Two Pistol Pete was written only for your amusement and entertainment. Hope you enjoy the story and can come visit our ghost town. The year was 1885. The small mining village of Bally's Mines, Missouri, was taking a giant step forward with the arrival of its first train. Bally's Mines is a town named after its first settler, Francis Bally, who in 1749 came to the region from St. Genevieve to purchase lead from the Indians. With the help of the Indians and some slaves, Bally and his family sank his first mine in the territory, and the area became known as Bally's Mines, when in French then meant the Bally family's mines. By 1819, the Bally Mining Company was formed, and by 1885, the town had gone from boom to bust twice. But this year would be a good year. The MR&BT, Mississippi River to Bon Terre Railway, was finally completed. This event would revolutionize mining and farming in the area and change people's lives for the next century. Up to this time, most supplies and exports were brought to and from Bally's Mines by way of the Selma Trail, using ox carts or mule wagons. Taking an ox cart of lead some 30 miles northeast up the trail and back with sundries and other supplies was a two-day affair and longer in bad weather. The little train could do all that and much more and do it much faster. The train was soon hauling ore, passengers, livestock, supplies for three stores, lumber, dynamite, and even the U.S. mail. This meant more work, more workers, and more business for the community. Once again, the tiny hamlet would be referred to as Boomtown. Barges and steamboats would now offload their cargo onto train cars, and the old Selma Trail would soon fade into the past. The arrival of this railroad was long awaited by everyone, well, almost everyone. Here is a story from a person from the past who lived during this era and saw how Bally's Mines changed. It was 5 p.m. and off in the distance a great rumble could be heard as the evening train approached Bally's Mines. Among the townsfolk who turned out to meet the train that evening was a farmhand, accompanied by two young boys named Gus and George. The mule team was tied to a hitching rail near the depot, and the boys played in the back of the wagon. Suddenly, the mules began to fidget around as the earth trembled beneath their hoofs. A mighty whistle sounded that could be heard for miles. As the big iron horse screeched its way past the water tower, Gus jumped up and down, yelling, "There she is! There she is! I see her! Here she comes! Here comes Pa!" exclaimed little George in excitement. "Now settle down, you two ornery ones. You're scaring the mules," warned the rough exterior farmhand. "They already scared half to death of that thing. Your Pa might be on that thing, and he might not. And don't you two billy goats get too close to it, neither." By this time, people were running from all around to join the folks who were already waiting to meet the train. Among them were two local storekeepers, blacksmiths, farmers, miners, and the constable. Even tie hackers working on the nearby hillside laid down their axes and hurried toward the depot. The ossement had finally come to pass. The engineer, seeing that folks were having a hard time keeping their children and beasts corralled, didn't blow his mighty whistle again. Instead, the train slowly chugged up to the newly built station and let out a loud as the steam was released. "I knew she'd make it," said Bill Burt. "She sure is a sight for sore eyes." Mr. and Mrs. Burt and the family ran the company store and the local boarding house. He knew that the train would be good for business. "Boy, oh boy, that thing sure is a-throwing a lot of heat. Reckon it could blow up?" Ben Richards asked several of the spectators at once. The engineer was just stepping down off the engine. "Oh, no, that's just steam. That's what makes her go. The only worry I got is keeping these things on the rail and young'uns off the track," he added as he glanced over to Gus and George and grinned. The engineer then turned his attention to Frank Snow, who was head of the railroad section crew assigned to the new line. "That stretch between Pappin Switch and here is just muddy road and loose rails. Had to slow the train down. It's dangerous there," said Mr. Bill, the engineer. From that moment on, the Mississippi River to Bon Terre, MR and BT short line, took on the nickname from some of the local skeptics as a muddy road and bad track. Nonetheless, it was here to stay. When the passenger door opened, a third person off the train was Mr. Peter B. Farnham. Pete was no stranger to the area or to the train. Much of the timber used to build the rail line and the cordwood used to fire the boiler of the train came off of Pete's farm. Legend has it that at one point Pete and his work hands butchered a beef a day for a month in addition to pigs and goats and chickens just to feed the workers that were putting in the railroad. Pete was not only a successful farmer but also a businessman of sorts. He and his wife Sarah ran a small log store near their home and supplied another store in the neighboring community of French Village. Pete's interest didn't stop there, not by any means. Pete and his work hands staked claims and operated a lead mine. Also, Pete had recently taken on a new job as timber agent and superintendent of the Valley Mining Company. This job was one that he didn't take lightly and was the reason he was riding the first train today. Valley's Mines was no place for a lightweight. Looking after 5,000 plus acres of mines, mills, smelters, and workers was a hardy task. It took a stern man of principle and authority, and Pete Farnham was just that man. Pete didn't possess a lot of book learning, nor he a whiz at figures. Clerking the store was Sarah's job. But he was chosen to run things because of various other characteristics. He was a no-nonsense person, strong in will and body, honest, devoted, a hard worker, but a simple man who was large and stout with a serious handlebar mustache. He didn't always have a lot to say, but when he spoke, folk listened. To those who knew him, just the thought of his stern, earnest face was enough to make any claim jumper turn tail and run. Pete didn't wear a badge because officially he wasn't a lawman. Instead, Pete wore a pistol on each hip, which commanded respect on even the most lawless of lands. Hence the nickname of Two Pistol Pete. His firm belief and frontier justice gave him a reputation only on to Pete. It was just keeping things straight. There is some doubt about whether Pete ever drew a gun on a man with any intention of killing him. That is up to now. Buck Jones was Pete's main farmhand and mining partner. Buck took care of things around the farm and up at the mine when Pete couldn't be there. Pete relied heavily on Buck to always be there and take up the slack. Buck had no family to take up his time or to prevent him from being Pete's number one man. He was a man of common sense and morals. Buck was a tall, thin man and quite muscular. Buck could split rails, hack ties, or crib a mine, and those were the main qualifications one needed to be favorably employed by Pete Farnham. They first met when Buck was staying at Burt's boarding house, where he saw Pete pass by there with an ox cart load of lead from the mine. Buck had been looking for work, and someone told him about the mines. He asked Pete if he needed another good hand, and before anyone knew it, Pete and two other workers were helping Buck build his house on Pete's spread. It wasn't really much of a house, just a two-room log cabin at the south end of the farm, but to Buck it was a real home for once. The cabin had a dirt floor and a dug well, but Buck was satisfied with it. Sarah and the children were also fond of Buck, and he was soon like family. Buck was always around to help, and he always seemed to take care of the chores that Pete never found time to do. No one ever knew or ever asked where Buck came from originally. He just came from somewhere up north, and that was all anyone would ever know about him. Some thought that he was probably from Iowa and had to leave there for some reason, but that didn't matter to Pete or anyone else. As long as a man was honest and hardworking and no one meddled in his personal affairs. Pete stepped off the depot platform with a small metal box under one arm and picked up little George with the other arm. George was right to work, checking his paw's many pockets for surprises. Gus, being the older of the two, stood waiting patiently while Pete lowered George to the ground. He then reached into his trouser pockets and brought out a large handful of rock candy. Both boys helped themselves to a handful. Then Pete spit out his chewing tobacco and popped the last piece of candy into his own mouth. "Now you boys be sure and save some of that for Sarah, for your ma and your sister," warned Pete. Of course, Pete knew that Sarah couldn't hear any of the candy, and she had in her order pants pocket for his daughter. Suddenly, little George asked, "What's in the box, Pa?" thinking that it might be another surprise. "Oh, nothing you need to know about," replied Pete. Buck knew what was in the little box, as tomorrow was Saturday, and the mining company always paid its men on Saturday. Pete never let the box leave his sight. As he and Buck loaded crates and bags of supplies onto the wagon, once the load was secured and the boys in place on the seat beside of Buck, Pete said, "Tell Sarah I'll be along shortly. Just have to make a trip up the holler." Buck nodded, then he said, "You never did tell us about the big ride home on the train." "Long, hot, and noisy," replied Pete. "Rode standing up most of the way and swallowed my tobacco every time that dang whistle blew. But I guess I'll get used to it." That was just Pete's way of saying, "It sure beats the hell out of ox carts, and I'm glad the train is finally here." The train in the world, for that matter, was moving at a faster pace than Pete was accustomed to. He didn't know just how he was going to adjust to his new pace. "Let's go, Molly," Pete said to his mule as he threw one tired leg over the saddle. Molly was Pete's favorite and most trusted mule. Pete had raised and trained her himself. Some said they believed she even thinks like old Pete. Molly headed up the valley towards the paymaster sack, where the company's payroll would be placed in the safe for the night and then dispersed to the miners in the morning. Pete was tired, and he let Molly mosey at her own pace along the winding creek trail to the paymaster's office. He liked his twilight time and claimed that this was when he'd done his best recollecting. Pete was thinking of how things were changing around the countryside. He thought back to when he was a boy and worked on his dad's farm alongside his brothers and a handful of slaves. Pete's father, Thompson Farnham, had originally come from Scotland to America in 1835, some 15 years before Pete was born. Thompson and his large family were seeking a better way of life in America. They settled first in Indiana, then Tennessee, and finally in Missouri, where they stayed. He remembered how wild and woolly things used to be in Missouri when he was a boy. He remembered helping his dad hide slaves in cellars and caves along the Platte Creek while the Yankee troops were passing through. Pete reflected back on a lot of things as Molly took him up the trail. He was deep in his thoughts when he found himself in front of the Valley Mining Company's payroll. The office was a small red building and was made to be very sturdy. The windows were guarded on the inside by iron bars that were made by the blacksmith who had his shop across the road behind the company store. Mr. Hawkins had also made the front door. It had hundreds of square nails driven into seasoned oak for security in case some hombre thought he would shoot through the door. Inside the office was a small roll-top desk, a chair, and a counter, a scale for weighing ore, and a safe. This was where miners came to stake their claims, turn in their times, get their pay, and then settle up with Mr. Burt in the company store across the road. Pete dismounted with the little black box still under his arm and took a leather string with two keys on it from his watch pocket. One key fit the big brass padlock on the door, and the other key was an ordinary skeleton key for the door itself. Molly waited patiently while nibbling at a clump of wild oats, while Pete slipped the box into the safe, spun the combination lock. He then stepped out, turned and double-locked the door. Across the dusty road, Bill Burt was just closing up the company store. Mr. Burt was glad to be in the new store building. The old log store building was damaged beyond repair in last spring's cyclone, so a new company store had to be built. "How'd you like that train, Pete?" Bill yelled from across the road. Pete didn't answer, but just threw his hand up in the air as if the verdict was still out. Louis Rosener, who was next door, was carrying his saddle to the carriage house, also noticed Pete and waved. Rosener was now president of the Valley Mining Company and resided in the Valley Rosener House, which in Valley's Mines. This was a large three-story house with five fireplaces and many add-ons. Built in 1837, it boasted a large summer kitchen on one end, five red rooms, dining room, parlor, office, and storage room. The structure, though mainly log, was now covered with white lap siding, and a white picket fence surrounded a yard full of flowers and shrubs. The company house, as it was often referred to, was well furnished with fine old furniture, antiques of the day, and wooden floors were covered with thick, lush hand-woven rugs. This combination created a plush yet cozy and comfortable dwelling. From this outpost, the Valleys and the Ravzeners controlled their mining empire. Directly across the road was the paymaster's office, was what was known as the Old House. This was the first settlement house where the original Valley had lived in 1749. It was a three-room, two-story log structure with a lean-to kitchen in the rear, and two main rooms were crudely made of hand-hewn white oak log and timbers. Pete himself had lived in this house for a few years until he was able to purchase his farm. The house was currently unoccupied, but would not stay that way long. Pete glanced up at his old home as he climbed on Molly's back for the ride home. For a brief moment, he imagined that he saw a face at the upstairs window, but soon decided that it was just the reflection of a tree limb in the late evening light. Giving it no more thought, he and Molly started home. As they went down the hill, he could smell the oak wood smoke as he rode past the charcoal yard. This was the area where cordwood is slowly burned into charcoal. The charcoal was then used to fire the ore smelting furnace. The process required an attendant most of 24 hours a day to make sure the fires didn't blaze up or get away. Behind the charcoal stack was the smelter furnace itself. This was the first and main Galena smelter, although there was two other such furnaces on the mining property. The furnace was of large cut stone for about the first 20 feet. Farther up, the tall stack was of clay brick made here on the property. The structure sat along the creek bank and was encircled by rock-walled water channels. The pond downstream had to have a dam high enough that the backwater would flood the channels. This water was necessary for keeping down the charcoal fires and for quick cooling of the lead ingots after they were poured into molds. George Roberts was the day man who fired the smelter, as other men took turns being the night watchman overseeing the charcoal fires. As Pete was leaving the valley, the sun was just starting to set. He could smell something good cooking when he passed John Penny's house. While the smell wafted in the air, Pete's belly started to growl. Pete was a big man with an appetite too much and didn't eat since 10 a.m. except a piece of candy when he got off the train. Pete allowed Molly to trot now as they passed the small Methodist church at the entrance of the valley. He imagined he could already taste the fine supper that Sarah would have waiting for him in the warming oven of her wood cook stove. "Just two more miles, Molly, and we'll finally be home," Pete said to his mule as they headed out to the ridge road. It was dark when Pete led himself and Molly through the back pasture gate. The chickens had already gone to roost, and from the barn, Pete could see the lamp lit in Sarah's kitchen. "Oh, how good it is to be home," Pete said to himself. Sarah was a good woman, a hard-working pioneer type, but soft-spoken and devoted to Pete and her family. Sarah's life not only revolved around her family, but also the chores and tending the little log store. Other women from the area who stopped in from time to time for supplies were company for her, especially while Pete was away. She enjoyed talking to women about children, sewing, sharing recipes, and catching up on the latest gossip. To Pete, storekeeping was strictly women's work. as were garden making, tending chickens, milking the cows, canning vegetables, and naturally tending to the children and house chores. Sarah did have help close by with Pete's farmhand, Buck Jones, helping out on the farm and across the ridge road from their house and store were two farms owned by two of Pete's brothers. Sarah also enjoyed spending time with her sister-in-law. After being married to Pete for 13 years, she was the one person who knew Two Pistol Pete all too well. To Sarah, Pete was really quite a predictable creature of habit. When he came home, Pete had a habit of stomping his feet four times on the porch, which would shake the whole house off its foundation. By the time Sarah could get to the front door, he would stick his head inside and yell, "Anybody home?" Tonight was certainly no exception. Seeing his wife and children run up to the door was always an unspoken relief and joy. Pete didn't believe in showing a lot of affection or any foolishness in the presence of the children, though he was glad to be in the company of his caring wife and family. He had something else on his mind as he asked, "What's for supper?" "Just old squirrel and gravy," said Sarah. "And there's some biscuits in the Mormon oven." Sarah was glad to see his tired eyes light up at the mention of squirrel and gravy. Next to goat or possum, fried fox squirrel was just about the big guy's favorite. After the Farnham family sat down at supper, Pete thanked the Lord for his victuals. The children began to quarrel over the squirrel heads. As usual, the brains being the tastiest part of the meal, Pete totally ignored the squabbles and continued eating as Sarah scolded the children. In Pete's book of rules, the father only punished his children if they had done something really bad. And even then, it was up to Sarah to punish the girls. Pete and Sarah talked about the day's events, including the train ride. Pete asked, "Did Buck put away the wagon load of supplies?" "Yeah, Gus and I helped him," replied Sarah. When everyone was done eating, there were enough bones in the middle of the table to choke three hound dogs. Sure was mighty good.